Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. One of my favorite programming features on KWGS is our Documentary of the Week slot, which airs on the station Thursdays at noon and then repeated again on Friday nights at 8. Documentary of the Week allows the station to broadcast informative content, often investigative in nature, and sometimes we run special series. One such four-part series aired here over four consecutive weeks in October and November. And if you didn't get a chance to hear any of it, we're going to speak today with the host and founder of the series, Dr. Anne Hallward. Dr. Hallward is a psychiatrist practicing in Portland, Maine. Her clinical work has taught her that shame, from any number of causes, is an epidemic that forces many of us to remain silent about our wounds and scars. Her intervention to combat shame is radio broadcasting, or as her show and documentary series, Safe Space Radio, tags it, the show about subjects we'd struggle with less if we could talk about them more. Safe Space Radio released a spate of documentaries on the Public Radio Exchange in early October, which meant they were able to be broadcast on public radio stations all across the country. In a year where there's been so much disruption, Hallward and her team retooled the documentaries they were making to include focus on the anxieties caused by the pandemic. There were episodes on each of the following: Climate Courage, From Violence to Voice, Profiles in Mental Health and Courage, and finally, Saying Goodbye. Dr. Anne Hallward is founder and host of Safe Space Radio, which has hundreds of podcasts free and available on its website on some of the most difficult to talk about subjects. Each episode is thoughtfully and lovingly rendered, and subscribers and listeners to Safe Space Radio attest to its therapeutic value. You can find out everything you need to know at the show's website, safespaceradio.com. Psychiatrist Anne Hallward, founder and host of Safe Space Radio, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Anne Hallward, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by having you just tell us about Safe Space Radio and the theme of shame that you explore so deeply in many of your programs.
Thank you so much for having me, John. 12 years ago in 2008, I was relatively new to practice as a therapist, and I started noticing that at the heart of my patients' suffering, almost no matter what they were coming to me for, whether it was depression or addiction, anxiety, trauma, the heart of their suffering was the same. That inside they were struggling with this terrible feeling of being weak or defective or a failure or damaged goods in a way that made them unlovable. And so they felt like they had to hide their deepest suffering, which of course translated to them being the most alone with it. And this is really what shame is. I mean, shame is the terrible feeling of being bad and having someone else sense it and recoil from you. And so I started feeling like I kind of stumbled across a public health emergency because shame was leading to suicidality. It was leading to isolation, aloneness, worsening addiction. So I felt like I needed to find a public health solution to shame. And radio seemed like the perfect thing because the speaker isn't being witnessed. They're not being judged about their hair or their outfit or, you know, it's so much about being seen and feeling visually exposed. The radio felt like it was very intimate without that kind of visual scrutiny. And also the listener in general to radio, unlike TV, is alone. So it's very private and intimate. So for 12 years now, we've been broadcasting shows that whose aim is to reduce shame, to use courageous storytelling of other people who have struggled with things that are associated with stigma or judgment or marginalization that affect our health. And to my surprise, it turns out almost everything that is hard to talk about affects our health.
Yeah, can you say more about that in terms of how things that are hard to talk about affect our health?
Well, in the most obvious sense, it's because we don't ask for help. You know, if I feel like I'm drinking too much, but I feel like that's a moral failing, then I might not tell my doctor. And then I won't get help for it that could really address the problem. The same thing goes with depression. You know, there's so much stigma about mental illness that I might not tell my doctor, I might not tell my partner, I might not seek help. So the barriers, stigma and shame, are tremendous barriers to getting the health care that you need that can be life-saving.
Now, you mentioned courage, and this recent series of documentaries, which we aired here on KWGS and I think aired on many stations across the country, seem to hold a theme of courage. And as I understand it, you see courage as related to shame. And I was wondering if you could unpack that for us.
Okay. So I have two stories about that, if I may. So the first story is from 30 years ago. I worked as a hospital chaplain in 1990 before I went to medical school. And I worked on two floors, an infectious disease floor, which is almost entirely gay men dying of AIDS at that time. And I worked on an oncology floor, which was mostly kind of middle-aged, straight, mostly guys, as it was, who were dying of cancer. And what I noticed was stunning to me was the difference with which people approached their death. And the gay men who were dying of AIDS were so open about the fact that they were dying. They were talking to their kids, they were talking to their families, they were talking to their communities about death and dying and saying goodbye in a way that was very moving. And on the oncology floor, well over half of the people I met with died without ever acknowledging to their spouse that they knew they were dying, without even having a chance to say goodbye, which seemed so wrenchingly painful. And I started to think that, you know, I really was puzzled about this, and I talked to a lot of people about it. And I started to think that courage was a muscle, and that the more you'd had to exercise your courage, the more it stood you in good stead when things got rough. And these men had to come out at a time in 1990. It was not common to be out of the closet, and it wasn't even necessarily safe. But they'd had tremendous courage young in their life to come out and affirm who they were in a culture that was not affirming of them. And what I found is that when it came to facing their death, it stood them in good stead that they were really courageous. And I admired that so much. And I started to think about how the antidote to shame, in other words, to remaining closeted, is to come out of the closet. So coming out started to become this paradigm for what it means to emerge from shame and to tell the thing that you've been hiding to the people in your life that love you or to your doctor. So I started thinking about what is it that fosters people's courage? I started thinking about my role as a clinician is to help foster people's courage. And that became fascinating. So then we started developing radio shows that were about fostering courage.
I didn't know you had been a chaplain. I think that's so interesting. And the contrast between the two units, the infectious disease unit and the oncology unit, as you've articulated, between men who were so open and men who weren't. And I guess I just wonder, did you carry that with you throughout your medical training, or did you sort of rediscover it after you'd been fully trained and then developed the radio program?
You know, it's so hard to really know the answer to that, John, like how your mind really works and to track it over 30 years. But I just always noticed it. And I want to be fair here to the guys with cancer. You know, there are many forces that supported the kind of denial. And part of it is the culture of oncology itself. You know, there's so much pressure to fight this, to win, to cure it, to beat it. And the culture of the oncological team is so focused on aggressive treatment and trying to reach that cure that there often wasn't a lot of straight talk with the patients about, you know, no, we're here focusing on quality of life now. You know, we're going to try to give you as long as you can, but we're not going to be able to cure this. I rarely heard that kind of really honest conversation from the clinicians. So I think that patients came by their confusion or their uncertainty about dying for so many reasons, not only because it was naturally frightening, but also because there was a lot of pressure to maintain hope. You know, there were a lot of books out there about hope itself helps you boost your immune system. And so the spouse might not want to talk about dying because they didn't want to rob the patient of hope. And the patient might not want to talk to their spouse because they didn't want to, you know, witness their grief. There's complicated reasons that are loving reasons, too, that made it difficult. The last thing I want to do here is, you know, blame the victim. But I do think that facing very difficult truths was something that the gay men dying of AIDS had practice with in a way that I hadn't in the same way. So yes, it informed everything I did. I mean, I was always struck about that. Like, how do you help people face the truth in a way that isn't crushing, that is ultimately, you know, encouraging? So maybe 3 years ago, perhaps it was 2017, I had the honor of interviewing Ibrahim Rasool, who was the ambassador to the United States from South Africa Under Nelson Mandela, he had been an activist fighting apartheid and had been imprisoned with Nelson Mandela and was part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission they had there in South Africa. And as you know, that was a commission where the people who'd been involved in doing the torturing, doing the murdering of the black Africans, came and acknowledged, confessed what they had done to the families, to the communities, received amnesty for that confession as a way to bring healing, as a way to give the truth to the families who had suffered. And before the interview, unfortunately, before I had pressed record in the interview, he said to me, we were sitting in this little dark car in a side street in Camden, Maine, and he said, well, Anne, do you know about the role of the psychiatrist in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission? And I was like, no, I don't know it. And he said, well, almost everyone who gave testimony was given the opportunity to meet with a psychiatrist before. And he said, the role of the psychiatrist was to encourage. He said, that word needs a hyphen. We use it so casually, to encourage. But he said, with a hyphen, it means to foster the courage. And I started to weep and kind of basically botched the interview because I felt like he'd handed me my vocation. I felt like he'd finally put into words what I'd been trying to do for years and years. And I knew I was doing that on the radio show to foster the courage of my guests so they could tell their most vulnerable and most generous and courageous story. But after that interview, I started thinking about that clinically, that in my work as a psychiatrist with people trying to recover from overwhelming trauma or, you know, life-threatening depression or paralyzing anxiety, that my role was to help them access their courage to keep going day after day, to face it, to bear it. So I became really, really fascinated in courage as it applies to our health.
That's really quite amazing. And I'd like to reintroduce you here. You're listening to Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Anne Hallward, who is a psychiatrist based in Portland, Maine, and host and founder of Safe Space Radio. And Safe Space Radio has produced some radio documentaries that have been shared on the Public Radio Exchange that we broadcast here on KWGS in October and November. There were 4-hour-long documentaries, and Ambassador Ibrahim Rahul, he was featured in one of them. I want to say it was the one about From Violence to Voice, but I may be wrong about that.
No, you're right.
I heard his voice again.
Mm-hmm.
And were you able to talk to him again? That was so interesting to hear his testimony, really, about Truth and Reconciliation. And if I remember correctly, he talked about some of the things that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission got right and some of the things that he wished it had done better. But he said it would be an important model for other communities, other nations even. And in particular, you talked about structural racism here in the United States as but one example.
Yes. So I did not record him again. That was an interview that we hadn't air broadcast yet. So we used it, later because it was still so true that whole show, as you know, it was about how difficult it is to break silence after violence. That we don't think of it really, but violence is so often shrouded in silence. For the survivor who feels ashamed for having been victimized, the perpetrator, who of course is ashamed for having done this heinous thing, but also in some ways shame fuels violence to begin with. And lastly, for the bystander, and we focused on white racist silence in response to racist violence because there's so much shame about the history and the ongoing racism in this country and the kind of paralysis about knowing what to do about it. And he offered that the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation model, brings together the survivor of the violence, the perpetrator of the violence, and all the bystanders in a way that breaks silence and acknowledges the truth of what happened as a prerequisite for healing. So I do think it's time for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in this country about racism that this country was founded on and that has lasted to this day.
You know, on that documentary about violence and, or as you call it, From Violence to Voice, you also featured an interview with somebody named Martha Minow, who was formerly a dean of Harvard Law School, and very interesting. And she talked about structural racism and I think quoted from the end of the Kerner Commission report from the late 60s even about what the term of art in those days was race riots, and how I can't remember the name of the individual who she was quoting, but who said the end of the Kerner Commission discussing racial violence in the United States could just as easily have occurred in 1919 or 1921 or 1935. Again, you name the time or the era, and yet again, now 50 years beyond the Kerner Commission, we still have yet to make any of these structural changes to bring equity or fairness. And I thought this was so interesting, but so haunting and so powerful and disappointing, frankly.
Yes, I so agree with you, John. It was Kenneth Clark who said, you know, the findings of all of these commissions could echo each other and none of them have been followed. And she called it a kind of institutional forgetting, that we just keep wanting to sort of brush under the table the degree and the extent of racism in our society. It's so painful to face it because it's so awful. And yet, it really is time. It's well overdue. And the thing, you know, so Canada did have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission with their First Nations people, the term they use there for Native Canadians or Indigenous folks, and they built reparations into the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as a way to kind of head off at the pass all the pressure to sort of forget it once it's done. So I think if we were to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in the U.S., it would be important to build in something meaningful that would result from it right up front.
Yeah, it's also interesting to note, I think, at least the way Martha Minow described it, that reparations weren't only financial, but also rhetorical in some way.
I know. I'd never heard of it before. She called them structural reparations. So it wasn't just handing out a pocket of money to all the descendants of slaves. It's making institutional changes at all the gatekeeper levels so that access is more available. And I found that fascinating and hopeful.
And I wanted to ask you about another of the documentaries that you recently produced, and this one was called Climate Courage. And 2020 has been such a difficult year for so many of us related to issues around structural racism with the murder of George Floyd, and of course the COVID-19 pandemic. But Climate Courage has not really gone out of the headlines. I mean, it's gone out of the headlines perhaps, but it's been on the front page with the amazing number of hurricanes that have occurred this year. I think particularly of Central America being devastated, but wildfires all over up and down the West Coast. And as you point out, extinctions continue. And so climate change is something, and I know President-elect Biden has appointed former Senator and Secretary of State John Kerry to be his, I guess, really our first climate czar. And anyway, it was such an interesting documentary because you essentially, if I understood correctly, you were talking to various individuals about how we have to have courage to face climate change. And first, we have to really acknowledge it, which is significant. Portion of our population really doesn't, that global warming is occurring. Can you share what some of the themes or messages in that documentary are?
Sure. So I think the mental health challenges to facing and really feeling what comes up about climate change are one of the reasons why we're not being very effective at addressing it. So it felt like something, some small thing I could do as a psychiatrist was to try to offer people a way to help with, you know, the tendency to minimize or deny, as well as the deep, painful feelings of despair and grief, hopelessness and fear that it brings up. So we had people telling stories about each one of these deep feelings and how they have coped with it. For instance, one of the women talked about, a young woman who has not yet had children, she talked about her hopelessness and her really struggling to ask herself, you know, is it ethical to have children knowing where we're headed? And apparently, you know, several surveys published show that very high percentages of young people are really asking themselves this question. And she, you know, it was such a painful decision for her because she'd always wanted to have a child. And she finally decides that hope is a verb, not a noun, that even if she doesn't have hope, she can choose to hope and kind of orient her life around being hopeful. And so she leads women's groups now to help people wrestle with climate change. And so she's kind of poured her life into trying to, as she calls it, nurture the future. And she still hasn't made a decision yet about having a child. But by using her energy to nurture the future in other ways, that's how she's kind of working it through at this point, which I found to be a really powerful way to handle it. Another example is Kate Shapiro, who's a professor at Brown University in Providence. Her husband is a cartoonist, and so she'd always seen those cartoons of Lucy from the Peanuts cartoons. You know, she has that little psychiatry booth that says,
"The doctor is in 5 cents."
That's it. The doctor is in 5 cents, please. And so she created a little Lucy from the Peanuts cartoon booth, and she calls it Climate Anxiety Counseling. And she sets up shop right outside the bus station at county fairs. Every weekend she does it. And she has people who come and sit with her and talk to her. This was all before COVID, of course. And tell her about their fears. And what she does is she connects them to local organizations that are working on climate change. And what she's found, and which I found too, is that fear thrives in isolation. And that if we come together with others who care, we start building our courage, we start building our resourcefulness, our creativity, our ideas, and we work together to do something meaningful. And then people feel incredibly empowered and rewarded by what they're doing. So her work is really powerful in helping individuals move through their fear into finding their courage and their community.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Anne Hallward, who is a psychiatrist based in Portland, Maine. She's also host and founder of Safe Space Radio, and Anne Hallward has done, I think, over 300 themed radio shows with a theme of shame, but around so many issues in mental health and psychiatry, advocating and talking to people who are revealing their stories, often for the first time, and really trying to move away from shame and come out into the light. And it's very empowering. And Safe Space Radio has, I guess you could say, morphed a little bit into doing radio documentaries with more of a national span. And four of these hour-long documentaries were released in October. They were aired here on KWGS in our Documentary of the Week slot. And I guess I'm wondering, you had one of the documentaries was called Saying Goodbye. And it talked about a number of things, but I guess at end of life. But of course, many of these documentaries had to be retooled for the age of COVID. And I guess one of the more poignant features was just how lonely and awful it's been for many folks afflicted with COVID-19 who have been in hospital and been unable to have their loved ones come and be with them at a time of great health crisis. But there were many other aspects of saying goodbye and just how important it is. And many things I took away from that documentary, including writing letters to deceased loved ones, or journaling, of course, being always very important. But also, you know, really, I think dread saying goodbye or fear it. And in fact, it can be something that's so affirming and so positive. And I guess there's always that fear of acknowledging, you know, the imminent death of a loved one or a friend. There's just so much packed in there. It's really worth a listen. And we'll link to it on our website. So if you missed it when it was aired, you can always listen on your computer or your smartphone. But in that documentary, Saying Goodbye, how did you set that up, or how did you even know how to approach the topic or who to talk to?
Well, as I said, back in 1990, you know, I had worked with people dying for a year, so I felt like it was something I really had it in me to do. So I'd wanted to do this show for years and years. And we have a lot of subscribers, so I think I put out a call to our subscribers to say, does anyone have a story to share? I think I might even have posted it on Facebook as well. But I also knew people who had shared with me that there, you know, I had a friend who's a colleague, a therapist, whose mother had died of COVID. She hadn't been able to be there with her. And, you know, a nurse had been holding up an iPad to help her have these last conversations. And it was so moving and difficult. The most painful part for me was that her mother, who of course is dying and therefore a little bit out of it, a little bit confused, you know, looked so sad and upset that no one was with her. Which was so heartbreaking to my colleague that her mother would suffer like that. And, you know, she found so many ways to tell her that she loved her. But it's so painful not to be able to hold a hand or stroke a cheek, be physically present when someone's dying. And so many people around the whole world are experiencing that right now. So it felt so important to give that experience voice and to talk about what had helped her cope with it. Including, you know, telling the people you love that you love them now. Don't wait. Don't wait.
Right. One of your guests had, this was actually not a guest, but I think a friend of yours or someone who you knew who was very open about the fact that he was dying. And if I'm not mistaken, he was someone who had, under death with dignity, was able to end his life by his own choice. And he told his loved ones that if they had anything they wanted to say, they needed to say it now.
Yes.
And then he, as his health gradually waned and he was going to administer the life-ending drugs, he told everyone to actually leave the room, which I thought was kind of surprising.
You know, one of the things I've learned, John, is that it's not uncommon for people to prefer to die alone. So often, somebody will be keeping vigil, and they'll be there night and day for days, and then in one moment they run to the bathroom, they're gone for 45 seconds, and that's when their loved one dies. I've heard that story countless times, and they feel heartbroken about it, like, oh, I wasn't there, as if they'd somehow failed them or abandoned them. But I've learned now not to be surprised by that, that it is not uncommon at all for someone to prefer to just slip away on their own without having to worry about the anguish they're causing the other person, to see it in their face, or their own vulnerability and feeling so exposed as they die. So rarely do we acknowledge this, but now, of course, it's totally different with COVID, because that's, if you have a choice to die alone, it's one thing. If you don't have a choice, I think it feels devastating. So that's an important distinction to make. But I many people do. In that show, I tell a story about my own mother. She and I were reminiscing about my dad's dying, because we were both there holding his hands, and it was incredibly moving to me. And my mother, who's a lifelong introvert, says to me out of the blue, she goes, "Anne, will you forgive me if I prefer to die alone?" And I was like, oh my God, Mom. And then, I was really quiet, because she was very earnest. She was a very serious question. And then I said, well, Mom, yes. Will you forgive me if I do everything I can to be there? And she was like, yes, I forgive you. And so it felt like one of the best times we'd ever been able to acknowledge we are so different, and what we have needed from each other have been so different, and it's okay. We can forgive each other. It was wonderful.
I love the anticipatory forgiveness. That's great.
I know. I know, but she was the one who kind of helped me get, like, oh, maybe she's not alone in wanting that. Maybe this is a thing that people hardly dare put into words, but perhaps this is more common than we realize.
Dr. Anne Hallward is a psychiatrist in Portland, Maine, and the host and founder of Safe Space Radio, which has been in production for years, but most recently has produced 4-hour-long radio documentaries that were featured here on KWGS in October and November, and we will link to them on our website. So if you miss them the first time around, you can certainly listen to them, and I would highly encourage you to do so. Dr. Anne Hallward, thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me as your guest and for your support of my work. I truly appreciate it.
I think it's great work, and so glad to have you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Bye.
Anne Hallward is a psychiatrist practicing in Portland, Maine. She's the host and founder of Safe Space Radio. You can learn more about it at its website, safespaceradio.com. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.